Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Thank you, Koshin. Did I pronounce that right, Koshin?
Got it right.
Chris would be easier, but it's up to you. What do you want? Well, thank you all for coming. Wow, this is a big crowd. In fact, do you mind if I take a picture of this?
No. It's a big crowd for Bashaw.
Well, it's a big crowd for anybody, and you know, my wife sometimes doubts my importance, and so I just want to. What's that? You should all just try to convey your admiration for me. There, yeah, that I think that did it. That'll do it. Okay, well, thank you all for coming. I'm going to talk a little about the book. I know not all of you are meditators, although many are. Is this sound about right, by the way? I'm going to try to talk in a way that's accessible to everybody, but not boring to anybody. That may be impossible, but anyway, if I go over anything too quickly, there will be a question and answer session, which you can ask me to elaborate. I feel I should start out talking about the title. Now, tell me, and be honest, don't worry about offending me. How many of you, when you first saw the title, thought it was like a little obnoxious or off-putting or skepticism-inducing? How many? Okay, you can all leave now. No, it's perfectly legitimate thing to question to raise. So let me try to convey what I mean by the title and try to defend it. First question is, what do I mean by Buddhism? I don't mean the supernatural part. I'm not talking about reincarnation and so on. I'm talking about the part that you could evaluate from the standpoint of modern psychology and philosophy, which is what I try to do in the book. To be a little more specific about it, the part of Buddhism that I'm kind of focusing on, I guess, is, you know, at the heart of Buddhism, I would say, is a pretty simple-sounding claim that the reason we suffer and the reason we make other people suffer is that we don't see the world clearly. And when you think about it, as simple as it is to say that, it's kind of an amazing claim because it suggests that in principle you could kill three birds with one stone, right? By seeing the world clearly, you would not only have clarity of vision, you could also become happier and become a better person. If indeed it's true, as Buddhism says, that we have illusions about ourselves, we have illusions about other people, about the world out there, and that is the cause of our suffering and the cause of our kind of misbehaving, you might say, or behaving badly or inconsiderately toward other people. Now, Buddhism not only claims that in principle you can kill three birds with one stone, it offers the stone. It has a path of kind of teachings and practice that in principle can clarify your vision. Certainly a big part of that is meditation, and I talk a lot about meditation in the book. Mindfulness meditation, or Vipassana / mindfulness meditation, is the tradition I'm most familiar with. There's been a lot about mindfulness meditation lately. You know, it's kind of in the air. It often has kind of a therapeutic vibe. It's something you use to deal with anxiety or stress, and I do think that's an important part of it. But one thing I try to emphasize in the book is that mindfulness meditation is also connected to kind of the depths of Buddhist philosophy. And that, you know, even if you have a practice that you think of as kind of therapeutic, just dealing with stress or whatever, that you're closer than you may think to a path of real philosophical and spiritual exploration. And I try to I try to provide the context for that in the book that will help people do that. Now, of course, I'm not the first person to say Buddhism is true. Many people have said that, notably Buddhists, over the centuries. You might ask, like, what entitles me to suddenly put it on the cover of a book, is if I have something new to say. I want to assure you that I do not claim that I had some deep meditative epiphany that gave me special insight that I'm going to now share with you. You don't have to worry about that happening tonight. I'm not all that great a meditator. I have a daily practice. I have been on a number of meditation retreats, and of course on a retreat you can get a little deeper. So I do feel that I have had brushes with the kinds of experiences that more adept and committed meditators, you know, people who go off for months in the forests of Thailand or wherever, the kinds of experiences they may have had, and which you know, in Buddhism involves the kind of experiential apprehension of deep truths, of kind of deep claims that Buddhism makes about the nature of our connection to the world. So I feel I've gotten some insight into these experiences from my time on retreats, and also I've talked to a lot of these more adept meditators, and all of this is in the book. So anyway, I do not claim that I've had some special, you know, illumination while meditating, that I'm coming down from the mountaintop and sharing it with you. What I do claim is that there's a kind of illumination of the logic behind Buddhism that is available now that wasn't available 40, 50 years ago. And that's illumination from modern psychology, and in particular evolutionary psychology, which I've gotten very interested in. And evolutionary psychology is basically the study of how natural selection shaped the human mind by engineering the human brain. And I wrote a book about evolutionary psychology in the 1990s. And I emerged from the experience of researching that with a couple of takeaways that were not altogether uplifting. One is that we were not designed by natural selection to be happy. Okay, when I say designed by natural selection, I'm using designed kind of in quotes, because natural selection is not a conscious designer, but it does create animals that look as if they were designed to do something. And ultimately, what they were, quote, designed to do is get genes into the next generation. I mean, that is the bottom line. Those traits that are most conducive to getting genes into the next generation are the traits that will spread through a species. And this simple principle seems to account for all of the life we see around us, amazing as that seems. Now, one thing that means is that if the suffering of an animal will help get genes into the next generation, then suffering there will be. Okay, because natural selection doesn't care, quote, about our happiness. It just cares about getting genes into the next generation. And when you think about it, this accounts for some features of life you may be familiar with, such as the fact that gratification tends to evaporate, right? You eat the donut, feels good for a little while, that wears off, you hunger for another donut. You have sex, feels good for a while, but then you would like, you know, down the road, you would like more. There's some promotion or some other kind of elevation of your stature that you've really worked for, looked forward to, feels good for a while, it wears off. That seems to be the human predicament. And when you think about it, what else could you have expected from natural selection, right? I mean, if you imagine an animal that just had one meal and then just went, yeah, I'm good, that's it. I mean, I was never hungry again, that animal would die of starvation. And, you know, same with all these things, you know. The animal that has the most opportunities to get genes into the next generation, it's going to do better than fellow animals. That means staying alive in a sexually reproducing species. It means having sex. In our species, it does seem to have meant, you know, working for status or for the esteem of your fellow human beings, because that does seem to have been correlated with genetic proliferation. Now, as many of you know, this thing, the fleetingness of gratification, is much emphasized in Buddhism. It kind of comes under the larger heading of the impermanence of things and our attempt to attach ourselves to things that are going to be impermanent, and our failure to kind of reckon with the impermanence, and that being a source of suffering. And by the way, the word that is the ancient word that is translated as suffering in Buddhist texts, dukkha, a lot of scholars think would be just about as well translated as unsatisfactoriness. And that really perfectly captures what you would expect natural selection to build into an animal, a kind of perennial yearning for things to be different than they are, a little better, a little more of this. So there's this recurring dissatisfaction built into us. Now, according to Buddhism, this is itself a kind of illusion, a kind of failure to see the world clearly, because you really, you know, you look forward to the gratification that all these things will bring, and you pay no attention, you know, as you're pursuing them, to the fact that the gratification will be fleeting. And again, it makes sense that animals would be like that, because if they spend too much time dwelling on the fleetingness of the gratification, they just might not pursue the goal in the first place. Now, you might say, well, that's not an out-and-out illusion. It's not a misperception, you know. It's just kind of an asymmetry. You're just kind of paying attention to one thing, the gratification, not thinking about the other. And it's true. You could argue that. But certainly, just to establish that natural selection can build out-and-out misperceptions into people. Here's another example. People tend to overestimate the speed at which objects are approaching them. And when you think about it, that too kind of makes sense, right? I mean, if there's a wild beast chasing you, or somebody with a spear chasing you, whatever, better to get out of the way too soon than too late, right? Better to err on the side of caution. Better to be safe than sorry. And this seems to be a principle that natural selection has paid to in other contexts as well. So if you're taking a hike, did they ever have snakes on...
No.
Okay. Suppose they did.
Bear.
Cougar.
Is that one?
Yeah, cougar can work. I'll try to adapt this to cougars. Okay, so you've heard about somebody being killed by a cougar attack, and you're taking a hike, and you hear like a rustling in the woods. You're probably going to go, cougar. You're probably going to feel fear, and you're probably going to be wrong, right? That's a false positive. What's that?
They killed the cougar?
Oh, there was only one cougar? You gave me a really lousy example. We're going back. We are going back to snakes. Who put you in charge of this?
There's nothing else dangerous out here.
Okay. Suppose the cougar was reincarnated as another cougar. Okay? So there's a cougar. You're taking the hike. You hear the sound. You're probably going to go, you know, cougar, you're probably going to be wrong. And if out of the woods jumps like a Labrador retriever, you may briefly think you see a cougar, right? And this is human nature. So this is a literal illusion, and it's associated with suffering. And it just shows you, again, natural selection, strictly speaking, doesn't care about your suffering, and it also doesn't care whether you see the world clearly. So you can see why I emerged from, I wound my way from being interested in evolutionary psychology to being interested in Buddhism. And another thing I discovered from evolutionary psychology is that these problematic feelings like fear and anxiety, when you put us in an environment that we weren't designed for, it's not like the hunter-gatherer environment that humans were designed for, things get even worse. So you take feelings that they're natural to begin with, like anxiety. I mean, evolutionary psychologists would say, well, it's natural for a parent to, if their toddler runs off and they realize they haven't seen their toddler in a while, to go, oh God, what's happened? Something horrible's happened, and go try to find the toddler. That's natural. You would find that in a hunter-gatherer environment. What's not natural is to drop the toddler off at a daycare center on the first day where you don't know anybody at the daycare center. That's going to cause a kind of a special kind of anxiety that actually, unlike the first kind, is entirely unproductive. I mean, there's nothing, no good is going to come from spending that whole day worrying. So too with social anxieties, you know, it's natural. Evolutionary psychologists would say to care about what people think of you, to worry about what people think of you. It's not natural to do what I'm doing, stand up and address a bunch of people you don't know. That's why people have public speaking anxieties. And again, those are, they're pretty unproductive, you know. Some people have, they actually are beset by the illusion that they will start projectile vomiting or something while speaking. This is a specific thing that some people have. Not productive, not plausible, it's an illusion, it makes them suffer. And it's just another example of how the modern environment can complicate an already perhaps problematic situation with human nature. So anyway, I emerged from looking at evolutionary psychology with a kind of diagnosis of the human predicament that had a certain amount in common with the Buddhist diagnosis, as you can see. I mean, there is a lot of suffering, there's a lot of failing to see things clearly, and here we are, what do we do about it? Well, that's the part that evolutionary psychology doesn't tell you. It offers a kind of a diagnosis, but it doesn't offer you a prescription. Buddhism does, so maybe it's natural that I found myself at a meditation retreat in 2003. I had tried to meditate every once in a while. I had never succeeded. I have a very limited attention span and other things that are not conducive to meditation. And somebody suggested that I try a week-long silent retreat, so I did. And after a couple of days of intense frustration, it started to kind of click. And by the end of the week, I felt transformed. I mean, I just felt I had a whole new appreciation of the beauty of things in which I had not previously seen beauty. I felt my vision was almost literally clearer, just seeing the texture of things at a finer level. I was much less judgmental of people. I remember at the beginning of the retreat, you know, I was kind of like sizing everybody up. There's like 80 people, and since, you know, you're not going to be talking to them, so you might as well just size them up on entirely superficial ground. Which, I don't know about you, is what I generally did anyway. And I remember seeing somebody who had a T-shirt that said Juilliard on it and thinking, oh, well, aren't we special? We went to Juilliard. And then at the end of the retreat, you know, when they broke the silence and we could ask questions of the teachers, this guy got up and he was the most timid, insecure guy you can imagine. And I thought, well, you know, I guess I got that one wrong. But by that time, I almost didn't need to know that because I was just way less judgmental of people and things in general. When I called my wife at the end of the retreat, you know, she said, before I had even said anything about the retreat, she's like, I like the new Bob, just based on the tone of my voice. This is what she says, that as soon as she heard that that she was sold. I also, on the retreat, had in a way, my first kind of big breakthrough in mindfulness was, it was one morning, maybe the third day, I was starting to be able to focus on a number of consecutive breaths finally and so on, and I was meditating, and I had too much coffee, and I had this kind of agitating feeling in my jaw, like a grinding of my teeth. You know, it was really unpleasant. It was intruding on my meditation. I'm like, what am I doing here? And then I said, well, wait. What you're supposed to do with mindfulness meditation is not run away from unpleasant feelings, experience them, examine them. And so I kind of did that and just decided I'd live with it. And suddenly I felt like, well, okay, that feeling is in my jaw, but I'm up here. And so it's really not a problem for me. And suddenly the feeling was still there, but it was just not problematic. I was kind of observing the feeling. And since then, I've done that sometimes with anxiety. When it really works well, it's you can almost like view anxiety as if it were like a piece of abstract art in a museum, just kind of appraising it, interesting, but doesn't hurt. And then it tends to slowly dissolve if you get to that point. None of this is easy. And you know, the most dramatic examples for me tend to come on retreat. I mean, as many of you know, sustaining the daily practices more challenging, and kind of the most you can hope for is to hold on to some portion of what you might have at the end of a retreat. But anyway, for me, it's been enough to motivate me to have a daily practice, to go to further retreats. So, you know, I've lately been averaging, I guess, about one a year. Now, I want to let me, in the interest of not spending too much time talking before we open up to Q&A, let me say something that may be more comprehensible to people who have a little bit versed in Buddhist philosophy. But what I want to say is, you know, I said that meditation can be more than therapeutic. And I know this, what I've been talking about, you know, just visualizing your anxiety or experiencing it, changing your relationship to your anxiety in a way that, that zaps it of its power to cause you pain, that's a pretty therapeutic thing. But I think of that as being connected to, there is this deep concept in Buddhism called not-self. Taken to its extreme, the idea is that the self in some sense does not exist. Leaving that aside, it's certainly the case that, that some very deep meditators have had what you might call the full-on not-self experience, where they feel as if the self is dissolved, or they were confused to think of them having this solid self in the first place. And I just want to say that I think even when you change your relationship to your feelings a little and don't identify so closely with an individual feeling, that's a little bit of progress toward the not-self experience. And in fact, if you talk to meditators who have done the whole deal, you know, these very adept meditators, which I do in the book, some of them recount that very path. You know, it starts with changing your relationship to the contents of your experience, not identifying with individual things so closely, not attaching yourself so closely to them. And that can be the beginning of a path that leads to deeply liberating experiences like not self. But there's an increment of liberation just in letting go of anxiety, right? So that is, an increment of liberation. And I think it can be an increment of insight as well, because, and this is one reason I get into the evolutionary backdrop of these feelings, I want us to understand that some of these feelings, they are misleading us. They're not worth paying attention to when you look at the whole, you know, way feelings came to be, what feelings are for, whose agenda they're serving, why natural selection designed them, and so on. So one reason I get into the evolutionary stuff is because I think it, in many cases, reinforces what in Buddhism is, you could say, a certain skepticism about the extent to which we should accept the guidance of our feelings. At a minimum, I would say, the minimal claim you could make about what Buddhism says is that you should at least be skeptical and, like, look at individual feelings and decide whether you want to go along for the ride. I want to close by talking about another deep Buddhist concept called emptiness. Now, like not self, this sounds crazy or radical or whatever the first time you hear it, and it depends on which version you hear. In one version of emptiness, in one interpretation, it's like we're in the matrix and nothing is real. I don't think that's really the mainstream interpretation in Buddhism. The mainstream interpretation says things like, well, things are empty of inherent existence. But I think what is meant is something a little more accessible than that. And I want to illustrate that by an experience I had on my first retreat. So I was walking through the woods and I saw a weed called the plantain weed. And it was the exact kind of weed that I had spent a fair amount of time trying to kill, because it was the kind of weed that had infested the two lawns I had owned, and I had spent a lot of time, like, pulling them up. You know, I, for the most part, tried not to resort to chemicals, but this was the enemy. And I looked at this weed, and I thought, why have I been trying to kill this weed? Because suddenly it looked as beautiful as everything else in the forest. Now, at one level, this was a kind of a trivial observation, because I was just, in a way, what I'm saying is, like, you know, when I say, why do we call this a weed, I'm just saying, look, weed is a human-imposed category, right? Weeds don't have weeds stamped in their DNA. You know, from, like, a God's eye view or whatever, the universe's view, it's not like, oh, these are the weeds, and, you know, there's no rigorous definition of what a weed is. Weeds are just a bunch of different plants that people in various cultures have said they don't want in their gardens or they don't want in their lawns. And so that's like not a very profound observation. It doesn't take long to explain. But what's interesting is what a deep perceptual shift accompanies the kind of experiential apprehension of that simple point. Okay? And you realize that you had been infusing weeds with a kind of essence. There was like this essence of weed thing, that they this vibe they were giving off, and you weren't thinking about it because it was infiltrating your perception subtly through your feelings. But it's this distinct thing, and when you drop this idea of essence of weed, it's transformative, and the weed looks a lot more beautiful. And by the way, this you know. I talk in the book to people, these adept meditators who have had this experience of emptiness, and even some of them say they kind of walk around, they cross through some threshold, and they walk around having the experience of emptiness. It's the way they perceive the world. And they describe it in ways very consistent with what I said. They said things project their identities. You know what they are. You know that's a chair. You know that's a wall. But things project their identities a little less strongly than they used to. And what they universally say, at least the people I talk to, is everything is better. I mean, everything is more beautiful, or everything has more of a, exudes more of a positive energy, or whatever. And I don't, I should probably start opening up for Q&A before long, but I want to say that the book is very much about what I've been focusing on. I mean, you know, how I guess a way to it. The reason I emphasize that this is not just about therapy; it's about getting a clearer apprehension of the world and ideally becoming a better person is because it's not just a book about how to be. There are plenty of books about how to be happier. My claim is that Buddhism offers a path to what you could call a valid happiness. A happiness that does involve a clearer view of the world, clearer view of other people, and ideally, accordingly, better behavior. And on that last point, clearer view of other people, better behavior, this question of essence really comes in. Because it's when we see essence of people, essence in people, that the moral stakes of this emptiness question become big. You know, when we, or groups of people, when we get a kind of a vibe, when we think about members of one ethnic group or one religious group, you know, we're kind of attributing an essence to them, or to individual people. Let me just talk about one cognitive bias, and then I will be quiet. That is very much related to this. You know, you've heard about cognitive biases. Probably, like confirmation bias is this tendency to be open to information about that supports your view, but not remember things that are inconsistent with you. That's a cognitive bias. There's another one called the fundamental attribution error. And what people originally thought, the way it was really originally conceived, is we tend to, in explaining people's behavior, attribute too much explanatory power to their disposition, to the kind of people they are, and not enough to their circumstance. So if you're in a checkout line, you see the person in front of you being rude to the clerk, and you go, well, that guy's a jerk. Which may be true. Maybe that he's habitually rude to clerks, but it may well not be. It may be that he had a horrible day, he got some horrible news, who knows. And psychologists have shown that more often than you realize, this is not typical behavior, and so you're wrong to see essence of a jerk. But it turns out it's actually more complicated the way this bias plays out. Here's the way it works. With our friends and allies, if they do something good, we attribute that to the kind of person they are. We say, yeah, good people, they did it. If they do something bad, we explain it away with circumstance. We say, oh, it's peer group pressure, you know, or they didn't get their nap or whatever. With enemies and rivals, it's the opposite. They do something bad and we go, yeah, well, that's typical. That is essence of them. If they do something good, we explain it away and say, well, they were just showing off or they had no other alternatives. And I think this is, it gets us into wars. It's the reason people who champion a given war go to such great lengths to demonize the leader of the opposing country, although sometimes they are fairly demonic to begin with. But in any event, the point is, once you get somebody in this enemy box, they can't get out. Nothing they do will get them out, because anything negative they do, anything bad they do, will reinforce the enemy image, and anything good they do, you'll explain away. I also, time permitted, would talk about how I think these kinds of cognitive biases are at work when you in the political polarization that afflicts America. I think you see them on both sides, my side and the other side, and they're sustaining and exacerbating the problem. And one thing I like about mindfulness meditation is, I think, because these cognitive biases tend to be triggered by feelings, like the vibe you're getting from the person you put in the enemy category, for example, and the way that triggers how you're going to process information about them. And because mindfulness meditation, when it works, makes you more aware of your feelings as you go through life, as you're in that checkout line, it makes you more aware of feelings bubbling up and gives you more in the way of an option of, like, not following your guidance. I think meditation can play a big role in reducing conflict around the world. And I guess I will leave it there. I could go on, but I'm sure you either have questions or don't. And if you don't, then you may go on. But if you do, you should raise your hand. No questions?
Give it a minute. Yeah. I have a question. I'm about halfway through the book, and so I'm well into the modular mind,
mm-hmm.
that whole model of the modular mind, which is really interesting and sort of neat and tidy kind of rationale. And I'm just wondering, you present that as a model from evolutionary psychology, but do you think things are really that neat and tidy?
I should explain to people. So the modular model of the mind is the idea that, and this gets, it's related to this not-self idea. I mean, part of what Buddhists would consider the illusion of self is the idea that the conscious you is this kind of CEO making all the decisions and, thinking all the thoughts. And whereas sometimes you'll hear a meditation teacher say, especially on retreat, they'll say, like, thoughts think themselves. And what they mean by that, it sounds kind of odd, but what they mean by that is, if you get your mind in a state of sufficient calm, and you're observing feelings and thoughts, the thoughts just seem to kind of float in from left field. It no longer seems like you generated it. And the idea here is that what we habitually do is we latch on to the thoughts and think of ourselves as their owners and their originators, but actually that's not what's going on. Now, this modular model, one virtue of it is it explains how that could be the case. And the modular model, the idea is, there's not one actor, you. There's lots of actors in your mind. And these are little, you could call them modules. That's, in a way, sounds simpler than it is. But they were designed by natural selection, perhaps at different times in evolutionary history, to do different things. So, for example, there's a module that is in charge of getting you to eat stuff often enough. And there's a module that maybe under certain circumstances tries to get you to impress the people you're talking to. And you may have been in a cocktail party and felt the conflict between the two, right? It's like you're talking to someone, but you can, like, see the hors d'oeuvres, you know? Well, this is, you laugh, but this is the kind of, you know, the idea here is very much that these different systems in the mind are kind of competing with one another for control of your consciousness, and a lot of the subterranean competition you're not aware of. And this could explain why, when you really calm down and observe what's going on, the thoughts just seem to come from somewhere, because then what would be happening is that different modules are kind of injecting different thoughts into your consciousness, and what the consciousness is really kind of an observer of the process that's under the illusion that it's in charge. It's clinging to the thoughts as if they're its own, but they're not really. So, now, were you wondering, how well... This is not, like, a proven theory. I mean, strictly speaking, there really are no proven theories in science. But this is this is not, it doesn't rank up there with the theory of relativity in terms of how much evidence there is for it. But I think it has a lot to be said for it. It is mainly evolutionary psychologists who have been its proponents, but not only them.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I'm grateful to be in the presence of a person who's got expertise in this particular area, because...
Now we have to find out if it's me, or you're talking about somebody else. It depends on what the question is.
It may be. I've pondered where humanity would be now in terms of consciousness, and that arrival at the place where we can see people for who they really are rather than how we perceive them to be, in the absence of war, genocide, and religious conflict. Can you speculate on that, Mike, being an evolutionary psychologist?
How plausible it is?
Where would we be as a species?
If people actually saw each other for real?
No, if they weren't brutalizing, mutilating, and murdering one another. Socially, in mass quantities.
Well, it's almost, I almost look at it the other way around. I mean, you mean, would we be better people? I mean, it seems to me, almost by definition, if we weren't doing that, yeah, we would qualify as better people. I mean, the way I look at it is, what would have to happen for us to quit doing that stuff? And I think I feel at home here. I was raised Southern Baptist, and so I'm going to get a little apocalyptic here. Which I naturally tend to do anyway. But my own view is, I wrote a book called Non-Zero about the whole direction of history and everything, and argued that we're on the brink of establishing like a harmonious global community, but it could well fall apart and dissolve in chaos, and there's all these weapons of mass destruction, some of which have not yet even been developed and so on, and you can imagine a horrible outcome as a result of the kinds of forces that you're talking about. And my view is, it may be the case that the only way to avoid that outcome is if people, broadly speaking, get better at understanding how their minds work, how feelings are shaping their thoughts, and get better at seeing the levers of control that natural selection built into our brains. You could call it metacognition, right? A kind of rising above the cognitive process and observing it. Meditation is not the only way to do that. But in my experience, mindfulness meditation is a very good way. And it's very hard to do. And that's one thing I want to emphasize. Natural selection, these things are built into us subtly. It's like when you talk to people about that cognitive bias, about how they view friends as opposed to enemies, and in explaining their behavior, most of them, they think about it and they nod their head and they go, you're right. They've been doing it all their lives, and they haven't realized it. And I didn't realize it until and that's how subtle these things are. So I guess I would say, what do we have to do to put an end to this stuff? And I think it may take something like, a grassroots transformation of consciousness that comes from just being more aware of how the mind works and how naturally deluded we are, as Buddhism has been preaching, and in a lot of the specific ways that Buddhism has been preaching.
It does seem that these natural critical phenomena that are occurring has a gelling effect of people's connection to one another. So I'm wondering, if there isn't guidance out there, if there is guidance out there.
So you mean it is hardening their feelings toward one another?
No, you look at the last 6 weeks, for example, where you hear the reports of people in the field about the relationships of people in the communities assisting one another at a time of disaster.
Right.
And you think, it's like getting stuck in an elevator together, kind of thing.
Yeah.
These are increasing. They're happening all over the world.
Well, yes. The challenge we face is, we move to a global level of social organization, is that we don't have the kind of external threat that has traditionally held societies together, or sometimes, which is a common enemy in the literal sense. If there aren't invaders from Mars or something, we're not going to have that. You're right that when it happened, when people are put in these situations, often they respond well. I basically, my view is you're right that there are people's fortunes are much more, are sufficiently intertwined. The fortunes of the people around the world are, in fact, intertwined enough that we should be pitching in. We are in the same boat. But there are things that keep us from recognizing that. And I would say situations like the ones you're describing illustrate how people can respond when they understand the situation, but I'm not counting on it happening. I mean, I don't yet see a kind of a contagion of that yet, I'm afraid.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions?
Okay. I would think that evolutionary psychology would posit that there are two things that are unlikely to happen. One is that we're going to give up sex, right, because it's really important that we pass our genes on. To do that, at the moment, we really need to have sex. The other is give up killing each other. Because my little group of hunter-gatherers is really, really important, and I need to believe that in order to survive. Right? And it's just bizarre, because one sees that people you hate the most are, in fact, people who are most like you. You know, if you're Muslim and you're a Sunni Muslim, you don't care about the Christians, you care about
Yeah.
It's a very depressing thought. That it,
so you're saying you think the forces are too strong to overcome, or they're going to be almost impossible to overcome?
I think they're going to be, my guess would be very difficult. So I like this.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, it is very, like, perception dependent. I mean, the Sunni and the Shia haven't always been like this. I mean, like in Iraq, before the invasion of Iraq, there was much more limited tension between them. And this is true of groups generally. I mean, when I was a kid, it was not quite scandalous that my sister was marrying a Catholic, but it was like worth noting, like a Baptist is marrying a Catholic. And now, all the Christians, you know, they would feel they're in the same boat, because you've got these atheists and you've got, you know. I mean, it's all very, when people... you know, it's all very fluid. This is kind of what my book, The Evolution of God, is about. Any given religion, their interpretation of their own scriptures can change very rapidly as to whether they see a case for belligerence or a case for tolerance in their scriptures. It all depends on whether the people they're talking about seem to be the kind of business, the kind of people they can do business with, or the kind of people who aren't a threat. So it's all, the good news is, look, I should say a few words in defense of natural selection, I think, having kind of bad-mouthed it for so long. We do, compassion is a natural thing. Love is a natural thing. Empathy is a natural thing. The problem is just the way we deploy these things. And that we do have this tendency to shower them on our own group. But we can see how fluid that is. And so it's not, the situation isn't hopeless, but at the same time, I mean, I'm kind of acknowledging the stubbornness of the problem when I say that I think we need more widespread self-awareness, an awareness of how our minds work, and that they're literally not designed to think clearly, and the purpose they may have served at one time, you know, their time has passed in a lot of ways. Just in a modern environment, you know, it's just, so maybe I think I'm probably agreeing with you. Yeah.
So back to prescription for a minute, that Buddhism offers. When you're talking about emptiness in your book, do you also talk about sort of the corollary, what happens with emptiness, the compassion that arises, that because if there is no labeling, no difference between, you know, mm-hmm. not talking about that, then that natural compassion, yeah, just arises. Do you address that a little?
Well, a little. I mean, there's two things. I mean, I don't think meditation automatically will make you a better person. I don't think everyone who meditates is filled with empathy for everyone. I do think there's a tendency for it to make you a better person. In part because it just, at the very beginning, when it just calms you down a little, that's constructive. But the other thing is this thing I don't totally understand, but I think it tends to be the case, which is that when you kind of relax your judgments about things, at least when you do it as part of this meditative path, and perhaps this is most effective when it's in the explicit context of Buddhist philosophy, I don't know, but when you relax your judgments and you start approaching something like emptiness, Like in theory, you'd think it could go either way. You think it could be, well, now everything seems horrible now that there's no differences between them, or now it's just all neutral and it's not interesting. It tends to be that everything seems more beautiful or more positive. That is the report of these very adept meditators. That is my own experience. And I have to confess that I don't totally understand why that is. I don't have a strong, like, you know, it could be, you could get metaphysical and say, well, the default state of consciousness is actually a kind of appreciative of reality, and then natural selection, like, takes consciousness and in some sense warps it because of the dynamics of natural, it wraps it around the self, and the logic of natural selection forces these, like, selves to have these agendas that kind of warp consciousness, and then maybe you're letting it default to its natural state. That is total crackpot speculation. I just, you know, I don't know, but it is, I think it's the tendency for things to be nicer, not neutral and not worse. Yeah.
I had a question. Do you feel like, I have a thought, I don't know, I want to hear what you think. Do you feel like the modules and the animalistic brain is on one end of the evolutionary spectrum, and that there's a higher level of consciousness that we're headed to, and that's part of the reason of the change, the social shift, and also the change in, you know, mindfulness is now super common. We're getting to that point that it's a rising trend, the level of consciousness?
I think, well, first of all, I would say you can't count on, I mean, there has been, in a certain sense, a growth in consciousness through biological evolution. You start out with, like, you know, single strand of DNA, you get more, you know, more and more complex animals, and you get us, and there's been a kind of growth of consciousness all along. Now, biological evolution itself is not going to carry us any further. It just doesn't move that fast, and I guess one thing I'm saying is there is going to be a need for an elevation of consciousness, but not one driven by changes in the gene pool, one that we, you know, strive for purposefully.
Yeah.
And you could say that in a way that is, in one sense you are, I'm arguing like for a rebellion against natural selection. And in a certain sense, you know, we're working against some of the mandates of evolution if we're trying to overcome some mental tendencies it built into us. But if you want to step back and view evolution in a larger kind of perspective, to include not just the biological evolution that got us to where we are, but the so-called cultural evolution, you know, technological, scientific, religious, whatever, evolution that got our species to the brink of a planetary community and has let us even build a giant global brain, the internet. You know, if you want to step back and see all of that as evolution, not just the biological evolution part, but all the technology and everything, then I would say that what I'm arguing for advances evolution, allows it to continue, because the next step would be a more harmonious global community, if that makes sense, if that's not too cosmic. Yeah, now, so I would seek guidance on how long I should keep going, but I would also say don't worry about just me and the fairy. What?
There's always another fairy.
Well, there is another fairy. There's another fairy. If you don't care about sleep, we just keep going.
Well, some of them probably care about sleep too. I mean, I'm gonna sign books for whoever wants that. Well, what is it? A fairy every hour?
Yeah.
And the next one.
Yeah. So there's a.
It starts going to be a self-work.
No, we're not going to get that late. Yeah. But basically, we quit. You quit talking now, and sign books, and you'll take that. You'll get the 8:20. No, I mean you leave at 8:20.
8:20.
And to catch the 8:40.
Well, I mean. I'm happy to keep talking. I also suspect that there are some people who don't want to keep talking. There's always this awkward tension. Yeah, they could leave.
Let's go for a few more minutes.
Okay.
Five more minutes, and then we quit, and then I think you'll...
Okay, yeah.
So I'm not even sure how to ask this question, but it's something that concerns me when I try to get into some kind of understanding of everything that we're talking about, mm-hmm. spending time, that all the, it seems like this, all of this becomes a little bit of a class thing, and that we're very fortunate that we're all sitting in this room, and I don't need to go on to the old liberal bullshit thing. I'm just saying there are so many people that will never have the opportunities that we have mm-hmm. to sit, not even to have the time to meditate.
Right.
Because they're too busy getting their next meal, going to work, right. taking care of their kids. That's the part that I find that it separates what I would like to do myself even with what the rest of the folks can do.
Meditation addresses first world problems, as
exactly.
they say. I think there's some truth to that. I mean, one thing you could do is meditate and try to do things that help people. One question that is raised about meditation sometimes is like, well, will it dampen my passion for social justice? I think that can happen. I think it usually doesn't. But in fact, I think for many of us, you know, if you have enough, like, passion about what's wrong with the world, a certain amount of meditation will help you pursue your causes more skillfully and spend less time enraged. And I think we see that now in American politics, a little kind of counterproductive overreaction to certain provocations. But, you know, I'm affiliated with Union Theological Seminary, and they now have a degree granting program in Buddhism, and their socially engaged Buddhism is a big thing that they're doing, and that's possible, that you can take it in that direction. But I take your point. I mean, it's also related to this critique that, like, well, mindfulness is being used by executives in Silicon Valley to more effectively squelch the competition, you know, and so on. I mean, my own view is that in general, on balance, I would just encourage everyone to do it. It tends to start out as self-help. That's just, you know, people are people. People everywhere want self-help. People in every demographic want things to be better for them. My view is it has enough of a tendency, they're not guaranteed, to make you a better, more considerate person, more compassionate person, less self-absorbed. I mean, that's the irony of mindfulness meditation. It does start with looking inward, but the idea is to make you less self-absorbed. I mean, after all, it's supposed to take you to the point where you either recognize the metaphysical truth of the self not existing, or at least abandon a lot of the stuff traditionally associated with operating a self, like ruthless striving and greed and all of that. So, you know, to some extent, the path is supposed to lead in the opposite direction from the one you're concerned about, which is just further self-absorption. I'm not saying everyone follows it in that direction, but, you know, many do. Yeah.
Well, when you're talking about the Vipassana meditation, are you talking mostly about a sitting meditation, or are you talking about a meditation that you, or a mindfulness that continues, an inquiry that continues into your, to every moment?
I think when it works, it continues into your daily life. And again, and I think, you know, the word enlightenment is in the subtitle of the book. I think, you know, that's, I like to think of enlightenment. I have no idea whether anyone has ever truly attained enlightenment in the deepest Buddhist sense of the word. But I think you can think of enlightenment as this incremental thing that you carry into everyday life. So if you are sufficiently mindful of your feelings that you see somebody who's rude to the clerk and you don't feel that essence of jerk, you like feel it coming on and you then just go, wait, I don't know. I just don't know this person. That is a little step toward empties. You have not seen essence in something that you would have otherwise projected it on. Or any, you know, I remember one of my first dramatic post-retreat experiences was my kids started misbehaving, at least as I define misbehavior. I had my own perspective. They had a different view. But and I just started to yell at them. But then I just felt the urge to yell. And for the, you know, unusually, I just observed it and decided not to pursue it. And that is the ideal, is that you carry this awareness of your machinery into everyday life and act on it, absolutely. But in my experience, you do need to keep meditating for that to be effective.
That's why they call it practice.
That is why they call it practice. You have to practice. So there's two questions here. Why don't you both ask your questions, and then I'll see if I...
At the same time.
Yeah, at the same time. And I will give my answer as you're asking the question. No. And then I'll give an answer in... Anyway, what's your question?
I'd just be interested in your thoughts, without discounting anything that you said, your modular analysis and evolutionary analysis, of the kind of absurdity and maybe even the futility of the mind, analyzing the mind.
It does sound paradoxical, I guess. In other words, what's doing the analyzing?
Well, when you talked about your response to anxiety, you step back and you're analyzing.
Like, who is the you that's...
Who's doing the
right
analyzing?
Well, I mean, in a way, you're raising the not-self. You're starting to get at some of the paradoxes associated with the idea of not-self, like in the Buddha's not-self discourse. He says that once you view every aspect of human experience as not self, then you are liberated. I mean, depending on the translation, it's either he is liberated or his mind is liberated or something. But the question is like, wait a second, what is it that's liberated after, if you're really letting go of everything, how can there be anything left to be liberated? These are paradoxes that I am not, it's just above my pay grade. And it's, they're interesting to think about. But I'm here to tell you that this shouldn't get in the way because it works. I mean, you can change, quote, your relationship to your anxiety without any doubt. That can happen. And or you can just think about the paradoxes associated with that. Either way, you can do both. But these are good.
Well, I would
this
say,
is worthy of the philosophical seminar.
I would say you should address your anxiety not by splitting yourself into two things, but by staying one.
Well, there's that too. It's like the language is tricky. People experience these things differently. Some people don't like you to talk as if you're detaching yourself.
Right.
Because after all, the process begins with actually experiencing the anxiety in a certain sense more fully, not running away from it, experiencing all its contours. So they're all you've honed in on a couple of good paradoxes that that I'm not going to resolve.
Well,
not tonight, possibly not ever.
Maybe there's an upper threshold there of what you can accomplish.
Well, there may be, but I've talked to enough people who have gone way farther than I've gone that I'm not worried about myself running into a speed limit anytime soon. I there's plenty of progress left. Was there? Yeah.
I recently saw some studies at UCLA where they gave end-of-life patients who were having a very hard time of dying psilocybin, and the experiences they had seemed to me remarkably like what you talk about, people who go through retreats where they became non-judgmental, they became much more sensitized to their surroundings.
Yeah.
And people who had had a very difficult time realizing or accepting that they were about to die suddenly came to be able to accept.
No, there's been much comment on similarities between psychedelic experience and mystical experience, and on the other hand, psychedelic experience can go a lot of places, including going haywire, and so it's hard to generalize. But there is a whole literature on this, and there's more study of it being done, including by, there's a lot of work coming out of Johns Hopkins on this. If you Google that, you'll probably see something.
Actually, they're using all kinds of psychotropics and psychological.
Yeah, not just psilocybin, yeah. Okay, so I should probably end it there. I can. There are no hands up anyway. So I'll. If you want, I can sign. I can sign book. Okay. This is truly the final question.
The final comment. You know, I think we just need to hold the Rohingya in our hearts, and that's happening in this country. There's not many, and it's a country that's a whole population is being forced out. It's a Buddhist country. The Buddhists really have struggles. So just had to put it out there.
No, it's true. People ask that question. And I mean, I've never been an essentialist about religion. I think all religions are capable of good and bad. I mean, people sometimes raise that as like an indictment of meditation. But of course, in Asia, lay Buddhists by and large don't meditate. These are not people who meditate who are doing the ethnic cleansing. But yeah, it's bad. It's horrible. And people of all religions are capable of horrible things. That was largely what my book, The Evolution of God, was about.
So I just had to hold it.
No, it's worth thinking about and even acting on. So thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.